This is Economics for Entrepreneurs, the podcast where we apply the principles of economics to help you make the best decisions for your life and business. Here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. In Economics for Entrepreneurs, we explore entrepreneurship as the best option for every one of us to create our own individual economy and to ensure that we feel economically enfranchised through our own initiatives. Entrepreneurship is the answer to your question about the good life you can have if you want to take control of your economic decisions rather than cede control. And since the purpose of our economic initiatives is to serve others successfully and profitably, we are at the same time helping everyone we serve to experience something better in their life. That's what value means to customers, finding a product or service that makes things better for them. So here at the outset, we're going to explore the role of the entrepreneur. Sometimes economists word that question as the role of the entrepreneur in the economy, or the role of the entrepreneur in society. But that's not the way that we look at it. There's no such thing as the economy or society. But there are service systems in which individuals and firms and resources and platforms are linked together for mutual exchange and trading. And the output is represented by services that we all consume. We're all linked together in a system of economic production. And this system has shown the capability of producing more and more value, more and more efficiently over time. The entrepreneur is critical to this function of the system, and therefore occupies a very special role. Here to talk about the unique role of the entrepreneur is Professor Per Bylund. He is probably the individual who is the most qualified in the world to do so. He's an economist in the tradition of dynamic entrepreneurial systems, a research fellow in entrepreneurship at Mises Institute, a teacher of entrepreneurship at Oklahoma State University, a writer of books about firm-level economics, and a regular series of articles in Entrepreneur Magazine, and he himself has been a serial entrepreneur. Thanks for joining Economics for Entrepreneurs today, Per.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
We have a lot to explore today. Let's start with your perspective on what it is that entrepreneurs do. The economic textbooks talk about rearranging the means of production and new ways to produce new value. They talk about seizing opportunities that are sitting out there unseized. Or alternatively, they talk about entrepreneurs creating opportunities that weren't there before. Others talk about them bearing the risk of future uncertainty, which I think is a really odd set of words to understand. Let's speak in practical terms about how you describe what the everyday entrepreneur does.
Well, I think that's a good way to start. You're absolutely right that the way economists talk about entrepreneurship is not all that helpful for people wanting to start a business or wanting to become self-employed and so forth. The issue here, I think, is that economists are trying to explain the economic system overall and explain what is going on in that system. I mean, what is the structure of the market? And do we get to economic growth and so forth on sort of very abstract macro level? This is, of course, not what any individual does. We don't act in order to increase the standard of living generally in macro terms or work in order to increase GDP. That's simply not what we do. What we do is try to create a living for ourselves. And doing that, the best way I think to think about this is to create value for others. You supply a good or a service, a new product or an already existing product in a new way or in a new market, and thereby provide a value that did not exist before, and thereby you would contribute to all these things that economists talk about, like the economic growth overall or GDP and so forth.
Well, in that language of creating value, which I think is a nice term, I've heard you talk about putting the customer's value first and creating business to produce this customer value. Can you talk a little bit more about value in that sense, especially value in the customer's eyes?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the way I usually talk about entrepreneurship when I try to introduce the concept to students and so forth is to make them realize that whatever it is you're trying to do as an entrepreneur, it's not really for you. So you should always, the way you put it, put the consumer first, because the consumer is the ultimate decider about whether it has value, whatever it is you're producing and that you're offering. And you should really start with that value in order to avoid making huge mistakes as an entrepreneur. So the first thing you need to do is simply figure out, is this valuable, what you're planning to do or that you want to do, and for whom is it valuable? So you need to identify who the customer is. You need to identify how valuable this could potentially be. And I mean, value is strictly speaking, it's on very subjective terms. So it's not in terms of dollars, it's just a sense of satisfaction from getting a product that helps us in our everyday lives, or from a service that makes our lives more convenient, or whatever it is. But this value is guiding for any business, simply because you can only charge a price that needs to be, that is lower than this value. So the best way of selling a product is, of course, to charge a price for a good that is so much lower than the value of that good for your customer that it basically sells itself. Many entrepreneurs struggle with trying to get the word out and trying to basically make the sale and sell the good or service to the customer, rather than letting the good or service sell itself by offering a promise of huge value and at a price that's so much lower that it's a no-brainer for the customer to buy this product. And then something I stress all the time is that what you do as an entrepreneur is just try to identify to whom you offer this value, set the price sufficiently low, and then your main task is really to choose the costs of doing this. So if you produce a good, say a new type of social media or something like that, and it's valuable to customers, and you realize that it's very valuable, and you charge a price that is sufficiently low to sell this good as a subscription or whatever it is. And after that, you know how much money you basically have to work with in order to produce this service. So you choose how to produce it in order to stay below the price that you can charge for the good. So you should really start. Most entrepreneurs, I think, make the mistake of starting at the other end. So they want to produce something. That's where they start. And then they calculate, okay, how much will it cost me to produce this good? And then how much will I need to charge in order to make a profit? And then go out and look and see, is this actually valuable to anybody out there? Which is exactly the wrong place to start. You should start with figuring out, okay, this type of good or service that I want to produce, is this valuable to someone? What is the market segment where this is most valuable? And then figure out what can you charge for it. And then the last thing you do, and the most important thing you do, is figure out how can you produce this value for these customers at sufficiently low cost to actually make a profit.
Well, that's right. And I remember when I was in industry, and the accountants used to talk about cost-based pricing. And what they meant by that was, we'll figure out the cost, and then we'll add some number to it that creates a profit margin, which is acceptable from an accounting standpoint. And that was cost-based pricing. I tried to point out to them the formulation that you just talked about, which is, it's really the other way around. It's price-based costing. What's the price the consumer will pay? That's the representative number of the value that they perceive. And then you work back from there. And so really, price-based costing is what accountants need to understand.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, unfortunately, we still teach the cost-based pricing method in MBA programs and so forth. And you're right, that's exactly the wrong way to go about it. You start with the value, then you get to the price, and finally you get to the cost. And then you also discover whether there is actually enough space for a profit to be made. You don't start with production costs and then add a markup in order to get the price. That's a great way of failing.
Right. The way to succeed is find out what the consumer will pay or the customer will pay, and then manage the cost to produce that value in order to be able to sell it at the price that represents a value. I think what you're talking about then can be summarized as price-based costing. The other term that we hear a lot in reference to the process you're talking about is customer centricity, or as Jeff Bezos at Amazon talks about, customer obsession. It's always starting with the customer, always starting with what the customer wants, trying to get things to them cheaper and better than they get before you came along with your new proposal, based on their input. Is that a good perspective for the entrepreneur?
Yes, I think so. I mean, what you do as an entrepreneur is trying to basically navigate the waters, but trying to get to the point where the customer is as satisfied as possible. I mean, the customer ultimately decides whether what you offer them is valuable. And what you need to do is figure that out. That's your task, and to deliver what it is that the customer actually wants and finds valuable in as cheap and fast and high quality way as possible.
And would you agree that this customer first process applies to any business, any small business, any entrepreneurial business? We tend to think about entrepreneurs as high tech, high growth startup businesses. But I'm always interested in understanding the hairdresser and the house painter and the high street retailer and the landscape service provider. They've got pickup trucks and trailers and equipment and an operational system and crews that go out and do the work. They're entrepreneurs just as much as the high growth Silicon Valley entrepreneur is, and they can use the same tools in what we're calling customer centricity or customer first, price-based costing and so on. Is that right? Do you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. And not only can they use the same tools, they should use the same tools. Unfortunately, I would say that they usually do not. I mean, if you start a new barber shop, for instance, you start out with just the assumption that, well, people need to get their hair cut and it's done in a certain way. So you just find a new location. And I mean, that there can be value in that, but there's probably more value for both the customer and for you if you figure out if there is a specific niche that is not populated yet, where there is no competition because no one has figured out that there is a specific value. There's a certain type of haircut maybe, or a certain type of atmosphere at the barbershop, or whatever it might be. I mean, I don't know, obviously, but I'm sure there are plenty of different ways of offering the service of cutting hair, but mostly these entrepreneurs doing this are focusing on cutting costs, probably because they see the price is set already by the market because there are so many delivering this this service, and they don't even think about the value for the consumer. But there's always a way of differentiating, finding your own niche, and thereby delivering more value. And then you can, if you deliver more value, you can charge more as well.
Well, I've noticed an example of that near me. You talk about a barbershop. There's a new hairdresser's. I think it's a chain. It's opened up near me, and I enjoy it. It's called, I think, Sport Clips or Sport Cuts. It's for guys. They don't take appointments. You just turn up. And the store has lots of television sets playing sports, so guys can come in. They can pass the time while they're waiting for a haircut, watching TV. And there's all kinds of sports memorabilia all over the place, and guys get to talking about it and so on. It's a different way of thinking about values, or about creating values, creating an atmosphere for a specific customer. In this case, guys who love sports, there's plenty of those, and giving them some fun and catering to them and saying you understand them while they're waiting for a haircut. So you're right. There are many ways to provide value in that kind of industry. And you said that some people have a hard time finding new ideas, but the new ideas are always out there.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, imagine if they would also serve beer or something like that, which would probably attract a whole lot more people. And maybe the first beer is included in your haircut or something like that.
Yeah, there might be some local licensing laws in the way of that.
Probably, but there might be enough value to actually go ahead and do this. And this reminds me that there was this dentist in Denmark somewhere who, in the waiting area where most offered water or maybe coffee, he started offering beer, which is very typically for people for Denmark, I suppose. But it turns out that it relaxed most of the customers. And of course, people going to see a dentist, many of them are nervous. So drinking coffee just makes them even more nervous and jittery and so forth. Whereas the beer calmed them down, and he realized that people really, really enjoyed not just the beer, but the whole dentist appointment, the whole lot more getting a beer simply because it relaxed them, it calmed them down and so forth. And he realized that they actually had so much better breath than when they were drinking coffee. So everybody gained, and that's sort of the beauty of trying these new things and figuring out how to create more value. And it could be these silly things like just beer in the waiting area for a dentist, but it could make an enormous difference.
Well, in fact, I think that points to a form of innovation that's available to a lot of entrepreneurs, which is combining two things that already exist and aren't necessarily innovative in themselves, but once you combine them, you've created something new. You've created a new service or a new experience. You've created an innovation. Dentistry plus beer is the one that you described. Neither dentistry nor beer are innovative, but when we put them together, they are.
Yes, depending on how you do it. Because very often, I mean, when we go through the motions and sort of start an artificial firm in the courses I teach and so forth, I always push my students, asking them, but who is this valuable for? And what is the actual value of this? And their common response is to add stuff, right? So you just bundle whatever it is you had first with more stuff and add more stuff. And then, of course, eventually you're going to end up with something that is specifically speaks to just one very narrowly defined market segment, simply because you have added so much different stuff. So there are only a few people who would find this valuable. But that's not actually innovating. That's not creating a new value. That's just combining different offers in one and the same. So it's different. Innovating a new combination that actually produces new value and just adding stuff together, which does not create more value. Those are very different things.
Well, let's dive into that a little bit, Per, and talk about innovation for the entrepreneur. Is it an imperative that an entrepreneur needs to be innovative? Let's say I've got a coffee and sandwich store and I found a good location. I open it every day at the same time. I serve my customers who come in for coffee in the morning and sandwiches at lunch and a snack on the way home, maybe. And they seem pretty happy, and I can just keep doing that. Or must I be looking for innovation all of the time?
You don't need to innovate in the sense of producing new goods and services and producing a new type of sandwich. But what entrepreneurs always need to think about is how they meet the future. Because it doesn't really matter what type of entrepreneurship you want to enter. You still need to satisfy your customer only when you have the good or service available. And information is changing all the time. And customers' views are changing all the time. And the competitive landscape that you're in, the situation, the business situation that you're in, changes as well. And you need to always adjust to this, but really you need to predict what's going to happen and try to position yourself with respect to what will be the case. I mean, a radical example of this would be having the sandwich shop and you expect that no one will want sandwiches a week from now. And if you're correct, you start doing something else and you can make a profit and all the other sandwich shops will go bust because people suddenly stopped eating sandwiches. Or maybe you expect people to really like sandwiches that have a specific shape or a specific color. Maybe purple sandwiches will be the new thing. And you expect this to be the case. So you start producing purple sandwiches and you create sort of a buzz around this, and you become known for this specific segment.
You said something there, Per, that sounds pretty challenging, which is, I think you said meeting the future, anticipating the future, always thinking about the future. And I've certainly read the term that the entrepreneur needs to live in the future because they're creating future value. So yes, they're always thinking about the future. They're always being prepared for the future. And I think that's what you're talking about, but how do you do that? What kind of advice can you give to entrepreneurs to do that anticipation of the future, to anticipate a future which is, as you say, inherently unpredictable?
Well, the short answer is if I knew, I would probably start a business instead of teaching entrepreneurship. The fact is that entrepreneurs need to do this, and if you don't do it well, you're soon going to be out of business. What you can do, of course, is try to look at different trends. You should talk to people, as many people as possible. When you start a business, the most important and probably the most hard thing to do is try to figure out the right people to talk to and get feedback that you can trust. But the fact is that you're always really looking to satisfy people. So there is a constant, even though the future is uncertain, there's a constant. And the constant is that you're trying to speak to people and what people might value. So it's definitely not impossible. I mean, what I usually say is that an entrepreneur needs to know two things really well. And one is to understand just generally the laws of economics. And the other is to understand people. And if you know both really well, and you understand both really well, then you're in very good shape to start a business and run a profitable business.
Yes, I always tell entrepreneurs that I deal with that just talking to customers, having conversations, talking to potential customers, talking to friends, anybody really, just talking, that will get you all of the information or most of the information you need and can expect to get about the future. You can talk to them about their feelings and their wants and their wishes. You don't need to run expensive surveys or pieces of research. Just talk, and you'll find out how people are feeling. You'll get a sense of the future, I think. That's the way that I look at it.
Yes, at least as long as you focus on the conversation bit and not the talking bit, right? I mean, you can't be a successful entrepreneur if you are an alligator, say, a big mouth and no ears. The point of those conversations is to figure out what it is that people actually want. So listening in and understanding where they're coming from is the most important part. I mean, when you talk to them and when you actually do the talking, the point of that is simply to get them to talk so that you learn what it might be that they're actually interested in.
Well, yeah, good correction. Really, listening is the point. The conversation is to start the customer talking and then you do the listening. So I agree. Let's talk about time a little bit, because that's also a challenge. We've talked about anticipating the future, but then it takes time to get from an identified improvement or an idea that I might have through the design and implementation of that idea and taking it to market. Maybe I've got to find some new resources. I've got to maybe get some capital. Maybe I need some new people on my team. I've got to find some investment funding, or I've got to save one part of my business in order to generate new funds for another part of my business. In that time period, you're not earning. You're planning and designing. What's the best way for entrepreneurs to think about that?
Well, the best way is, of course, to get paid before you do anything. So, I mean, in a sense, you can't really do anything about the fact that production takes time. What you can do is try to convey to your customer what it is you want to deliver and make them course, believe that you can deliver this and have them pay up front. And I think that is what is going on a lot online with this type of crowdfunding and all those websites where people basically commit a certain amount for a product, and the entrepreneurs say, well, if a certain number of people commit to paying this much for the product, we will produce it. Which of course helps immensely, because that means that you don't have to make the full investment yourself before you even have a clue about whether people want what you want to produce. Instead, you have the money to produce, and of course you need to do all the calculations yourself first to figure out, okay, is this the right price to charge? Can I, at this volume of production, have a production cost that is lower than that price? But still, it's a whole lot easier than making the investment and going at it sort of a waterfall model, where you just start with getting the funds, then you start production, and then you start marketing and maybe opening a store and things like that. That's, again, you should start with the value, right? And if you can get paid sooner and pay your suppliers later, then you're in very good shape cash flow wise. And I mean, cash flow is probably the main reason why entrepreneurs go out of business. Not that they don't have enough markup and things like that, but simply because they don't have enough cash to cover their outlays before they get paid themselves.
Well, that's right. That's the first rule of startups that we talk about in venture capital, which is don't run out of money, which sounds trivial. But actually, a lot of startups don't understand the management of cash, as you referred to it, and it's critical. Often in online businesses and in some others, we see the tactic of an entrepreneur offering a service free to see if there's any customer uptake. And then once they've got some customers, then they try to raise the price or establish a premium subscription level or somehow get to revenue. And that seems to me to be potentially fatal based on what you said earlier. You need to find out first what the value is and what the price is that the customer will pay for that value, and then figure out the finances around that. Do you have any comment on that business tactic?
Well, I mean, if you have a plan for it, I guess it could work. I see a huge problem or potential problem now that so many are trying to do the Facebook thing, basically, that they're trying to create something and get to critical mass of users globally and then sell the users, basically. That's what they're trying to do. And they don't even have a plan for how to get value for themselves out of this. I think it's a very risky strategy. And you always have the problem with, okay, if you're offering something for free and then you want to start charging for it, that's very hard. It's easy to lower the price, but you can't really raise the price without many customers dropping off. You could of course offer a framework and have people start using it and then add a layer of extra value and have them pay for that, but it's very difficult to foresee whether they will actually buy into that. And I would not go for any such business model, since it's high risk. It's potentially high return, I suppose. I mean, if you become the new Facebook, I mean, Twitter has tried and they're definitely not making any money. Groupon tried as well and they're not making any money. Instead, what we're seeing is that there are new startups and new competitors undermining their position, even though they were leading at zero revenue, basically. We still see others starting and taking market share from them. So it's not something I would recommend, not at all.
Well, that takes us to another question about entrepreneurship. And I know you have some thoughts on this, and that's, what if the entrepreneur makes a mistake? They make a bet, it's not right, or it doesn't turn out the way that he or she expected. The innovation loses money, perhaps the business has to be closed down or abandoned. The Silicon Valley folks are always talking about failure, which sounds horrible, but What do you think it says about the role of the entrepreneur?
Well, I mean, the entrepreneur does, as we started out saying, the entrepreneur does bear uncertainty, and that uncertainty is one's own business. And you can't know that a business will be profitable, or if you actually knew that, then anybody would start a business. It would be a sure thing. What you should do, though, when you try to run a business and it doesn't work out and you don't see a potential upside, that is very often you can have a period of very poor sales and then it turns around and you start making a profit later on. Unless you see that happening, what you should do is cut your losses, pull the plug on it as soon as possible. I mean, fail fast and learn from it. That's the best way of doing it.
Can the idea of the entrepreneur's role in the larger social system that we've been talking about be aspirational and motivational for people, especially young people? For example, I'd say that the business school industry over the last several years has marketed this idea of leadership as aspirational. Business leadership, how to become a leader, the aspects of leadership and everything that they sell at business school. It seems to me that entrepreneurs can build a better world, and the more entrepreneurs we have, the better. And shouldn't we be making entrepreneurship as an aspiration as opposed to leadership in the way that business schools teach it?
I think so. And in a sense, I guess we are. I mean, the entrepreneurship is considered sort of cool. Very often, unfortunately, it's in the sense of being one's own boss, which to any student would mean that they don't actually have to work all that hard, which, of course, to any entrepreneur, that's sort of a laughable proposition. The starting your own business doesn't mean you have to work much, or that you can work from home in your shorts and not get up in the morning and things like that. It's funny because a big sub-discipline in the study of entrepreneurship is social entrepreneurship, where the point is to help other people. And that seems to be something that a lot of young people really want to do. But it's funny to me because I see that as what entrepreneurs actually do. And we talked before about how entrepreneurs create value for other people. I mean, the way you have a business that makes a profit and produces a nice standard of living for you personally is that you, through your efforts and your business, provide a lot of value for others. So the concept of social entrepreneurship, I don't think there is any antisocial or unsocial entrepreneurship at all. All entrepreneurship is social. I mean, what you do is really try to figure out how to best serve others. And by doing that, you serve yourself as well. I mean, thinking about it that way, it's pretty obvious that entrepreneurship is a positive sum game where no one is harmed or hurt, and you're actually creating new value for people, and you get part of that through profits if you're do it well. And to me, it's a net benefit for anybody involved, and it's also a net benefit for society overall, with happier people and people who are better off and have resources to spend on other things and so forth. So in a sense, this is sort of the goodness of the market economy, where you can work with something that you are good at and that's something that you like doing, hopefully, and you become better off because you make others even better off. I see that as an amazing thing, really.
Exactly, and I think that's what I was searching for in talking about making entrepreneurship aspirational. To just repeat what you said, entrepreneurs make life better for other people. That's how the trade is made, the exchange is made between the entrepreneur and the customer. And because the entrepreneur is successful at that, they also make life better for themselves. And that rolls up to a better life for all. If we can capture that idea about entrepreneurship, I think the need for social entrepreneurship is a concept that will go away. It's just entrepreneurship.
Well, I hope so. I mean, in a sense, the social entrepreneurship, that idea is based on the view that profit is necessarily a bad thing. So social entrepreneurship is creating value for other people without thinking about prices, and basically offering them free services and doing so while not making any money yourself, of course, or even worse, if you do make money yourself, you basically get charitable donations from people and you take part of it yourself. But the thing is that means you have a huge problem in social entrepreneurship because you don't charge. So you don't actually know, and you don't get any feedback from your customers, quote unquote, that what you're providing to them is actually what they want. So you have this problem throughout the charitable sector, really, that you're offering a lot of stuff that you think that people want, but you don't know, and you can't get this information either. Whereas if you start a business, you still have to base that off of what you think that they know that they want and what you think that they need, but you get an immediate response through their actually paying for the product and their willingness to pay enough to cover the cost that you have for producing it. Whereas for social entrepreneurship, you don't get that. So you can go severely wrong in what you do and thereby waste resources at a catastrophic scale. And you simply don't know it. There's no way of figuring that out. So the risk of actually destroying capital and destroying value overall by engaging in social entrepreneurship is huge. So, I mean, you're right that entrepreneurship itself is social entrepreneurship, and maybe we should just drop the social. But in a sense, you can argue that what is usually called social entrepreneurship is not a boon. It could be really destruction of value. And oftentimes it kind of is.
Well, that's a very deep and important point to make. And I hope we can get entrepreneurs and business schools to understand that. Well, let's wrap up. I think we've established that the entrepreneur plays a great role in society by bringing value and betterment to customers. Those customers who seek it by expressing their wants and their needs. And entrepreneurs do that by opening a store or operating a delivery service, fixing cars, writing software code, whatever it might be. My question for you to leave our listeners with is, can anyone play this entrepreneurial role? Is it reserved for a few? And how can I decide if I'm going to be an entrepreneur and what kind of an entrepreneur I might be able to be? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think anybody can be, and in a sense, everybody should be, because the satisfaction you get from producing something is when you see that it actually makes others better off. And in a sense, you are, in a very limited sense, you are an entrepreneur when you go to work in the morning too. But you can really, as an entrepreneur starting your own business, you can leverage your skills and your interests in a very different way. And you can do good work and produce value simply acting in line with your passions. It gets back to really the point about social entrepreneurship that a good entrepreneur figures out a way of serving others. And it doesn't have to be a full-time job either. I mean, it could be that you just expand your hobby a little bit and invite others to do that. And if you can make a living off of it, then that's great. And then you're creating value for others and yourself, which is exactly what entrepreneurs should do. And I think if we just go about our days and think, okay, how can I best serve others? And is there something in it for me to do so? Then the world would be such a better place.
Well, exactly. And thank you for putting it that way, Per. Helping to serve others is what entrepreneurs do, and that's very fulfilling. I think we need to go, but before we go, where would you direct listeners to find out more about Per Bylund and your books and your writings and your thinking?
I would direct them to Twitter, probably. My handle is at Per Bylund, so at PERBYLUND, or to my website, which is just my name.com, so PERBYLUND.com. That's most of the information, as well as links to my columns at entrepreneur.com and so forth, are available from that website.
Well, thank you, Per. Thank you for your time today. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us at Economics for Entrepreneurs again soon. Thank you very much.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.